Okay, so that this is the end of the range retreat, Pohana day, and we do something a little bit different on this day, and follow a tradition that Ajahn Chah established when he was still teaching. And have the junior members of the community give a reflection, Dhamma reflection, so that tonight myself, Ajahn Dhurupala, and Ajahn Anipal get a break from giving teaching so we can listen, and other members of the community will give some sort of family reflection appropriate to the time, whatever manifests. And we've got the names here. So each person will come up and then we'll do the I'm a Morton and I'm a Sadhu at the end when after everybody's done. Oh, okay. Thank you, John. First stop.
Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. One theme that I keep reflecting on is the power of repetition to influence the way we think, the patterns that are in our minds. And the Buddha recognized this, and there are a number of reflections in our chanting book that are designed to be recollected again and again by one who has gone forth, or by anyone who aspires to the goals of Buddhist practice. The ones in the chanting book in particular are the recollection of the part of the 32 parts of the body, the recollection of the four requisites, the recollection of the five subjects for frequent recollection for everyone, and then the 10 subjects for frequent recollection for those who have gone forth. All of these are very good to repeat on a regular basis. And I've said it before, but I really think part of the reason why I came to the monastic path is just I, as a layperson, I started reciting the five recollections every day, without, every night, without fail. And just letting that, letting those five recollections, I am of the nature to age, I am of the nature to sicken, I am of the nature to die. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And I am the owner of my karma. Those five just sink in. And, yeah, just sink in because, yeah, there's no way to really counter them. There's, more recently, I've picked up a set of 10 dhammas which the Buddha recommends bringing to mind. It's less common, but this is the, it's an expanded version of anicca, dukkha, anatta. So, and so it begins with anicca and dukkha, and then I don't know the Pali for most of the rest, so yeah. But the idea is reflecting on the five aggregates as anicca, dukkha, and then a disease, a tumor, a barb, a calamity, an affliction, alien, disintegrating, void, not self. And I actually think I miscounted. There's 11 of them. So these, the context they appear in, actually they appear several times in the discourses, but one context is when I believe it's a Venerable Mahakotita asks Venerable Sariputta, what should a virtuous monk or a virtuous practitioner reflect on? And this is the answer that Sariputta gives. And then Mahakotita asks, well, and Sariputta says, the result of this might be realizing the fruit of stream entry. And Mahakotita asks, well, what would a stream enterer reflect on? And it's the same thing. And it just goes up the stages to what would an arahant, a fully enlightened being, reflect on? Same thing. So, not a... the list has some weight. And one thing in particular with this list is I've noticed, just as I've worked with it, there's nuances in it that I didn't realize at the beginning. The commentary breaks it into a very nice set of three groupings. There's anicca, which is impermanence, and then that one also, I believe, disintegrating is grouped under anicca. And then dukkha is, there's a many factors of dukkha in there. A barb, a calamity, an affliction, alien. Or, so a barb, a calamity, an affliction. It's all dukkha. And then anatta is alien, void, not self. So that was, and that's, Bhikkhu Bodhi has, that's in Bhikkhu Bodhi, the footnotes in one of the Bhikkhu Bodhi's works. But one thing that I noticed is that it's anicca and dukkha have, it really the emotional effect of them, it really matters how you translate them into English. And so I find Ajahn Chah's translation of uncertainty to be the most useful for anicca. And then dukkha, I experimented with various versions, but stress seems to, or stressful, seems to work very well. It's so broad in general. And so the beginning two are just, yeah, uncertain, stressful. And then I find it useful to pause right there. Because, yeah, just tremendous sense of empathy. You know, this is the way it is. Right, recognition. Uh-huh. And I spend so much time trying to make it other than that. But then just noticing, yeah, uncertain, stressful. Yep, that's it. And so then the next grouping of it, a disease, a tumor, a barb, a calamity, an affliction. This is when I say that all together and investigate, you know, investigating that, that's what it's like. That's what it's like when I grasp onto this, you know, uncertainty and stressfulness and try to make it something else. You know, it starts to, a disease, a tumor, a barb, a calamity, an affliction are all, they're a bit more personal than anicca and dukkha. You know, I've grasped it and here's real suffering. And then I guess the barb is particularly always poignant for me because it always reminds me of the times when I would be out on alms round at Wat Pananachat and be coming back with a piece of glass in my foot. And, you know, you ordinarily you're thinking about food when you get back from alms round, but you know, the food is totally secondary. You've got this piece of glass stuck on your foot. You need to dig it out. And I mean, you know, so you, as soon as you get back, I tell somebody else, look, I've got a piece of glass in my foot. I need to go into the bathroom and dig it out. Could you take care of my responsibilities before the meal? This usually takes a long time. And then just the tremendous relief when you finally get it out. Because until that point, you can't really walk very, you can't walk very well. If you angle your foot wrong, you'll get this, you know, stabbing pain, and you don't want to push it any further in. So, right, a barb. And then the remaining four, alien, disintegrating, void, not self, seem to be in a different group. This is another way to approach that anicca and dukkha. Alien has struck me as, yeah, this is, it's like the felt, sort of the felt sense of disenchantment. Just like the usual translation of anicca is impermanence, but the felt sense is uncertainty. There's, you know, disenchantment is a bit of an abstract noun, whereas alien, to me at least, comes up with this heart feeling of, yeah, you know, that's different, strange, you know, not identified with. I mean, I guess oftentimes people think of being alienated as, you know, it's an unpleasant feeling or perception. But in this case, yeah, it's if you found something more appealing, you know, more stable than the conditioned world, or have an intuition that it's there, you want to be alienated from conditions. They're an obstacle, not where you can find security. Yeah. And then, yeah, disintegrating is a bit like, yeah, similar, a bit here, it's uncertain, but, you know, or it's an aspect of Nietzsche, but it's maybe a bit like the, more connotations of letting go, the world sort of becoming less important. And then, yeah, void, this is sunyata, or empty, you know, this is empty. I'm certainly not going to go into all of what that means. I haven't investigated that too much myself. But there it is. And then, not self, which here is, yeah, it's the very last one, where, yeah, the world is, yeah, it's uncertain and stressful, but somehow it doesn't have to be a problem. And this is, so yeah, this list suggests that there, you know, there's a lot of work to be done between the perceptions of anicca and dukkha, and then all the way to anatta. Anatta isn't obvious. And I present this not so much as any sort of, this is absolutely the way it is, but just to demonstrate the usefulness of really picking up and repeating some of the Buddha's teachings. Because these teachings were originally memorized and recited rather than read. And perhaps only when we approach the teachings in the way that they were originally approached can we really understand their full impact. And it's not as if the volume of teachings that you know is maybe not as important as really understanding a couple of them really well. That may be more valuable. So, I've got many other people, many other fellow monastics, have much to say, so I will close here.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. When I was just a few moments ago, I was waiting for the fellow Prapasana to start picking people. I was like, what went through my mind was, well, you know, I'll be great as long as I'm not the first one. So, I get to be the second. There's a you never know what's going to happen, of course, until you go through something and until it's here, it's going on right now. Before I started this process of becoming and being an anagarika, I think a lot went through my mind. It's like, oh, you know, just 8 precepts, you're just wearing white, what's the difference? And next morning, next couple of days, you look down and you're seeing a body and it's covered in white and it's totally not what you expected it to be. It feels alien, different. Of course, then you get after a while you get used to it. Starts, you look down and go, oh, that's me, the kind of colloquial speech. Seems that the mind's habits, that same sort of tendency, something tends to arise frequently, or we give attention to that frequently. There's mood. I think, oh, I'm a happy person, or I'm an angry person, or tends to kind of stick and glob on. Tend to make that sort of very solidified. And of course, our practice is to try to see what really is going on. Are these things true? What is actually going on? How do we see these things more clearly? We're all here with sincere and similar aspirations and goals, so it's not an audience of people that be convinced that yes, there's suffering, there's dukkha, and this is something to be done here. So seems that what's useful, it's been useful, and not just for me lately, or just in general, just since I started practicing this path, just what's actually working, what's helping. It seems that We'll find something, we'll find a type of practice and or some sort of, you know, whether it's a type of meditation or we get really interested in I don't know, doing works of generosity or otherwise working on projects. Help others, help the monastery. Go, oh, this, you know, this, I can see this being helpful. And we can bring a lot of habits. We have a lot of core habits in bringing that about. Doing work, anagarika, you're spending a lot of time in the kitchen, of course. And when you're trying to prayer meal usually start around 8 o'clock, and depending, of course, the time of year, we try to ring the bell around either 10:45 or 11 o'clock. So you have about 3 hours or so per meal, usually two people, maybe three people in the kitchen. Of course, every day is different. You have different people, you have different items to work with. Of course, different moods, different things you're bringing into the picture, different states of health. And you can find something that works one day. Like, oh, okay, you know, I'll make this dish over here that worked really well yesterday, and I'll make this other thing, you know. Nice bean dish with black beans and some, you know, different spices. They work great. And of course, next day, you know, you go, okay, well, make some black beans. And of course, one of the people on the crew, I'm like, oh, I hate black beans, you know. Let's not make that. And you're thinking, oh, I'm the head cook, you know. Why is this person telling me, what to do? And when we get fixated on something that's sort of clinging around some sort of pattern or way things happen to be, that starts to give a rise to, well, just the internal, you know, that wanting to let go, wanting to hold on. And then if it starts outflowing, it can lead to, we're going to do black beans, I don't care what you say, or something like that. Or hopefully it's a little more skillful than that. or if you have an idea, today we're going to do, Mexican food. That's great. You know, I like Mexican food. And you have a lot of tortillas and tomatoes. And that's great. And of course, everybody's on board. You start to work on this great, theme meal. And about an hour into it, two different parties show up with a huge amount of donated food, which is fantastic. But you can have this holding on. No, today's Mexican thing. What are you doing with this, wonderful Italian and Thai food? Get out of here, After you go through various days of, working with different people, working different personalities, working different conditions, trying to sort of figure out the game, and constantly, just getting, beaten down over and over, trying to, this is the way the kitchen is, or I can make this prediction, or maybe if I make, So I said, well, wait a minute, what if I just let go? What if I just be kind? Mm-hmm. And of course, you get these inspirations. Being in a monastery is a great place to get reminded of these teachings. You see what happens. It's like, oh, wow, you try that and that went very easy. And it's almost like, isn't it? Things got done, food got put out, people were fed, people were happy. Of course, And then, of course, the craving or clinging will start to creep in again. It's like, oh, that worked out really well. What if, improve this, improve, change that, come in the next day. process starts repeating, get banged up some more. And so we, I think it's really important to have conditions or situations where we can see, you know, we're inevitably going to try things, do things, either internally in meditation or outwardly in the world, and just be able to reflect on what's going on, be willing to try things. And it's really helpful. You know, sometimes we can put ourselves in a situation, you know, where, you know, like, oh, you know, my own home, and, you know, I have people around me that I like, and everything's very fixed, and you know, that can be kind of cozy for a while, but this is not necessarily a situation that can help one learn. So just, I guess, a lot of appreciation for this opportunity to be in this kitchen that's so unpredictable, so many different guests coming in, and you know, even know what's often, you know, people have been here for, you know, over decades, to, you know, still can't give you much of a prediction on what's going to happen on a lot of days, and it's a beginning, or even quite a lot of it. It's absolutely exasperating, and you know, but this amazing opportunity to learn, to get teachings on about uncertainty and what happens when we cling, what happens when we relinquish. So, encourage everybody listening be willing to, you know, if there's an opportunity to be with something that's a little bit different than we're used to, that, and that has that sort of quality of, you know, unpredictability, of kind of being a bit out of one's, you know, league or comfort zone, and being willing to give it a try. Not just settle into complacency. So as a means of practicing, as a means of letting go. So I think I'll leave it at that.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Speaking strictly in the worldly sense, in a prior life, well, decade plus ago, I used to do a lot of public kind of speaking, sales, marketing things, and so I was hoping I would be able to utilize some of that, but it's been a long time. And since I wasn't so sure, I figured I would go back to the high school speech 101 strategy of tell them what you're going to tell them, tell them, tell them what you told them. And see how that goes. So the seed of this came about 2 weeks ago, this concept. It's been a very important concept to work with. About 2 weeks ago, Long Paul gave a talk about, you know, it was this concentration and samadhi, how, you know, people talk about samadhi and but how they really work together. And it brought up an important thing for me is vitaka and vichara. So I'm going to be talking mostly about that, but I thought it would be good to maybe start with, and this tell them what you told them stuff. This is certainly not in the Ajahn Chah playbook, but I'm not Ajahn Chah, so I'll just go with that. There was different reasons why I wanted to look at these concepts, and then, you know, kind of the things I investigated, how they, what I felt, what I learned from it. Really, just these two simple things really illuminated a lot of terms that I, and phenomena that I struggled with understanding. But really, I think the most important thing is really not the specificity of it, is just kind of approaching your practice and reflecting on how does your mind work and what works for you. So I've been practicing in the Goenka tradition probably for about a decade, and there was three things that were consistent problems or perplexing characteristics. One was I really felt a need that I needed more concentration, more emphasis on concentration. Second was in this process of waiting, it's very regimented, and I just never seemed to really, despite even, you know, feeling like I was actually doing it really consistently and well, whatever that means, I just didn't connect with anatta. I mean, anicca. He's constantly repeating anicca, not anicca, anicca, anicca. Change, change. And even though I felt like I was seeing it, it always felt like an intellectual understanding. I didn't really feel like... But the progress, there was definitely... don't want to downplay. I mean, radically changed my life and very, very thankful for it. And so I decided I wanted to try to... and there was another thing was that I really kind of was hoping that I could find someone who could... because I always, from the beginning, felt that the four foundations of mindfulness were all important, and one really needed to cultivate all four foundations of mindfulness. And Goenka really emphasizes the second foundation of vedana, and I really felt that I wanted to find somebody who could maybe teach me a way of looking at the mind in a similar, you know, some way that was, you know, accessible in a direct way. So I decided, I had a tendency to have a concentrative mind, but I really, really wanted to investigate the, you know, cultivating jhana states. And I don't really want to talk about jhana states, but this is where vitaka and vichara come in. We also have piti, sukha, and ekaga, rapture, joy, happiness, and equanimity. But when I looked at it in an analytical way, I really felt that this, the quality, and I'll define, the typical definition of vitaka and vichara, like vitaka is investigative, or a directed thought, like your application of the thought. And vichara is investigation. But really, in terms of concentrative states, it's more refined. It's application of the mind to an object, and then investigation. When it's in the mind, of course, thinking can be associated. But really, it's really, you know, application to a sense door. And if we're doing something like anapana, you know, we're applying the mind to the breath. We're investigating the qualities of the breath. So this is, you know, this is how I was really looking at vitaka and vichara. And my engineer, you know, son of an engineer brain said, well, really, you know, if you look at these five factors, there's got to be a process here. Why is this mind moving away? You know, this is the struggle. Often in the context of an instruction, it'll be like, you know, put your mind on the breath and some qualities and characteristic, and eventually the mind will wander, and then you bring it back. And it seemed to me that I really wanted to understand, why did the mind wander? How did it wander? And so, you know, when it wandered, instead of just bringing it back, there's some qualities and characteristics and things that can be looked at in this process. And, you know, this is a good practice to obviously do on the mat, but where a lot of it really kind of bears fruit is actually working with it in the flow of the day in the world. And what one will, you know, and the way to practice is definitely very helpful was for me in this regard was that this moment when the mind moves, it's a moment of sanya. It's a moment of like the mind contacting another object or a sound, a thought, labeling it, and this perception or associated quality in the body of pleasant. I like that. And you know, often the mind will move in association with, you know, we will be working with something, and you know, we can look at the breath, but it can get dull. It can get, maybe the mind will get a little settled and move into a state of neutrality, and then here's something, an idea, or here's a sound. Maybe that's someone's voice. I wanted to talk to them. And it's constantly playing this game of trying to find something other than what it's supposed to be doing or what you're applying it to. And in particular, where it struck me, I used to drive a lot for my another life I had as a construction worker. I drive for about an hour and 45 minutes in the morning. And I practiced working with Anapana while I would drive. And so there'd be periods like leaving at 3 in the morning where you're in the dark and you're going for long distances and it's just the headlights and staying aware of the road. And then I would hit like St. Helena, or I would hit Napa, or I'd hit Vacaville, or hit these different towns. And this explosion of lights or people or different things would occur, and just seeing the propensity of the mind to, that's an attractive light, that's an attractive color. And then the mind wanting to move that, investigate, tear it apart. What is that? And seeing just this tendency, this desire to move somewhere other than where the mind was at. And this kind of actually was another, where this really goes is to another thing that really perplexed me for years was the concept of guarding the sense doors. You know, often many refrains in the Buddha's dispensation, you know, talk about, you know, guarding the, you know, the eyes and guarding the nose, and he works with the senses restrained. And you know, on a physical level, it's very obviously we can, you know, keep our eyes downcast. We can try to physically disassociate ourselves with the world, but senses just impinge us. You can't like poke your ears out. You can't avoid smells. Thoughts are just going to be there. But at this moment of sanya, if you develop this recognition, this point of like, that is something, and that desire for it, this is a place before the mind really starts to roll in it, and it's a place where one can actually practice and develop a sense of self-control around this movement. And then after some time, another real beneficial thing that once you, is instead of, I mean, one thing I'd like to say, it's really still important to utilize, I felt for me at least, Anapana as an anchor. Come back to the breath. Recognize the mind wants to move. Understand that movement. Come back to the breath. But another fun little game that can be played with this is, especially with quirky things, is like, why did I think of that? And go, well, it's because of, that reminds me of when I was a kid. And that reminds me of, or that person talks like, you know, my old high school friend, or you know, she looks like somebody I knew from high school, or you know, many of these things are very, very young associations. And all, and this sanya, this perception, I'm not a big fan of words, to be honest with you. I think it's a very fortunate legacy of some Zen experience I had, but, because I really think they're a trap for many people. But what I really like for sanya is recognition, recognition. And this is what's happening, is an object is perceived, and it's really the recognizing of prior events that we're dealing with. We're not really engaged in purely seeing what it is, because that's very, you know, for the mind to do that, it takes a lot of time and effort. But we're like utilizing this shortcut of like, well, that's like this, and I like that, and so we follow it. And inevitably, you can still, even though if developing sense restraint, the mind will, you know, you'll roll in thoughts and you'll roll in desires and these kind of things. And back to Tonka Chana's point, this is a place with the repetition. We really see that when we have a tendency to roll in a thought, then later on that thought's going to keep coming back up. And it really, in these small moments of subtlety, all the inclination of the mind, either to stay with the object or move, are really, there's, you know, it's really entirely dependent upon a long pattern of being, you know, staying with the moment or indulging in the whims of the mind. And if we really embrace hard effort, determination, staying with sense restraint, we'll incline towards a mind that is much easily, you know, great word, very easily inclined to stay with it. But if we say, oh, well, I'm going to watch, you know, this in the lay life, I'm going to watch this TV thing, I'm going to listen to this music, and I'm going to indulge in this role in these thoughts about, you know, my mind is a very process-oriented mind, and it tends to go towards the delusions of inventing things. You get rolling in this wheel of making something. Well, that's where the mind is just going to go when given the opportunity. And this is, you know, this is karma. It's either wholesome karma or unwholesome karma. Are you inclining your mind towards attention to the moment, or are you inclining your mind towards indulging in a sense? And you can work on this for some time. And I found that you can be engaged in some, you know, grand idea of a career or some grand idea of a romance or how somebody is a bad person. And things can just come together and you can see how all of this is, there's nobody creating this. It's just a process of association that gives it an appearance. And I guess the most important is, for myself, was recognizing that my mind, there was a reason why it didn't incline towards anicca. It had an inclination towards anatta, towards the process. So, you know, I think that's, you know, it really isn't, you know, practice for, you know, certainly not for many people, I'm sure. But this concept of just this movement of the mind, investigative nature of the mind, is it was really worked for this mind. But I had approached that with this idea of working on concentration. And certainly concentration was a fruit as well, but really the discovery that, hey, I really should be spending more time you know, maybe approaching things from the concept of not self, because that's the nature of this mind to see things that way. And one of the real impetuses for me to come here was hearing this night Dhamma talk 2 years ago, and the amazing quality of this community and how everybody has had a different approach to Dhamma. And I think what, as an individual, really, you need to, you know, how does my mind relate to the world? And how can I utilize the teachings? Because they're all reflections of truth, which is beyond words. But we see it in a certain way, and that becomes our door to the truth. It's said that we'll find through anicca, dukkha, or anatta, and when we see that, we'll see it all. So look within yourself and find, how should I be looking at these teachings? Where does it work for me? Where does it not work for me? If it doesn't work for you, put it down. Don't be afraid to try different things. Listen to the people. But when something starts working, work with it. I'll leave that for reflection.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangang namasami. Yeah, I really like these nights as well. Last year I was kind of disappointed. It was very good having, last year Ajahn Jayasaro was here, so he gave the talk, and that was really nice, but I was kind of disappointed that I didn't get to hear everyone else give talks. And I was thinking, last year, so it was probably 14 months ago or so, I had been going to Fort Bragg with Ajahn Jodipalo or Ajahn Kurunadamo, and just hearing them talk about Dhamma, and maybe I asked them, or somehow it just randomly came up, like their thoughts around, like, how they seemed like they'd become, like, comfortable giving Dhamma talks. And Ajahn Kurunadamo gave the response, like, oh yeah, you know, if my, this is paraphrasing my understanding of what he said. He's like, yeah, if my Dhamma talk touches, you know, just one person, then that's enough. Then, you know, it's all I have to do. That's good enough. And then I think it was like a month later or something, Ajahn Jodipalo, and I have to, like, this is my own understanding, the way that I heard what Ajahn Jodipalo said, but it was something like, it was something like, you know, everybody's the owner of their karma, and if they don't get it, it's their fault. And so those were two encouraging thoughts that I had, like, last year as I was approaching to give the Dhamma talk that never happened. So just hold on to those. I thought one thing which I don't think many people are that interested in is here at this monastery is actually like Christian monasticism. And during my personal retreat, I did a lot of reading in Christian monasticism. I find it fascinating. And there's this story about Saint Anthony, who's kind of the lead. He was like one of the earliest, if not the earliest, kind of like desert father. So he was kind of like the Ajahn Mun of the 4th century Egypt. And
But yeah, I mean, it's amazing, the stories about him. But one thing, when he was just going forth, I mean, he was really inspired to take up the life, to leave the home life. And so he went forth, and he was just, you know, a spiritual athlete. And one thing which he did was he went out into the desert, and there were already, kind of hermits living around the desert. And, you know, what he did was go around to these different hermits who, like, specifically specialized in different things. So he went to the hermit who was really good at keeping vigils, and so he learned how to keep vigils with that hermit. And then he went to the other hermit who was really good at fasting, and then he learned how to fast. And then there was the other hermit who was really good at, you know, loving kindness or different things like that. And so he went, you know, to these different people and kind of picked up different things from different people. And I really liked that. I really liked that image, because that's kind of my experience of this monastery, and I'm really grateful for that. One of the other monks and I are doing this translation from every instance in the Pali Canon where it says, thus, bhikkhus, or thus, should you train yourselves. And there's one of them which comes from a sutta. Most people know the instance when Ananda goes to the Buddha and says, you know, half of the holy life is, you know, good friendship, kalyanamitta. And the Buddha says, don't say that. You know, it's the whole of the holy life. So there's that instance in the canon. But there's actually another instance where the Buddha is talking to, I think it's King Pasenadi. And King Pasenadi says something similar, like, oh, it's, you know, it's so important to have good spiritual friends. And then the Buddha actually refers back to that situation. He says, oh, once, you know, I was talking with Ananda, and Ananda said, half of the holy life is good spiritual friendship. And I said, no, it's the whole of the holy life. And then, so the Buddha's recounting this situation, which most people have heard of. But then he goes and continues, and he says a bit more to the king about how good friendship leads to growth in the holy life. And then he has a quote, which Bhikkhu Bodhi, which in the Pali is something like, I will be one who has a good friend, a good companion, and a good comrade, like singular. And it's Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as plural. So I will have good friends, good companions, and good comrades. And it's fascinating, and the other monk and I were looking at this, and we're like, what should we do? You know, Bhikkhu Bodhi certainly knows Pali better than we do. You know, should we go with good friends, or, you know, just a good friend, and that's all, you know, that's all we need. And I think we went with the singular, but I think actually we should change it. We should get yeah. And we haven't gone to print yet, so that's good, because... yeah, because that's really my experience, is that, you know, we have here at Abhayagiri, it's really, yeah, this is one thing which, this for myself and Tampu Muto, we ordained 5 years ago, 5 panchas ago, so we'll be finishing our first phase of the bhikkhu training. And in these 5 years, I can definitely say that I am grateful for the community here, and grateful for Lumpur, and grateful for the other monks. And that when Ajahn Vee was here last year, he said that just being able to be grateful shows that there's growth, you know, or that you're, yeah, that there's, yeah, kind of growth in the holy life. And, yeah, and I am grateful. Like, we have different kinds of spiritual friends here at the monastery. Like, there's, like, all of us have Lompa, which is like, which is Thai. It means like venerable father. And that's kind of like the friendship which Lompur kind of gives all of us. It's like the friendship of a father. And it's, yeah, in many ways very inspiring. And, but there do come times when it's like, you know, you can't just go to your dad every time you overeat or you oversleep, and it just gets old. And so fortunately, we also have all of the other monks and all of the other Anagarikas and novices and all of, you know, really good people who come to the monastery here. And it's pretty easy. I mean, it doesn't really matter, like, if the person's in robes or not. I mean, you can pretty much, you know, see people have, you know, different kind of good spiritual qualities. And yeah, that's something also I can appreciate. Yeah, it doesn't matter if someone's in robes or not, if they've got these good spiritual qualities. And I found it's really helpful to be able to hang around people who are, you know, specifically skilled in different kind of spiritual parami. One thing which I actually really appreciate about the monastic life, and I wasn't raised in a Catholic family, didn't know anything about confession or anything. I was probably thought it was weird, because we didn't do it. I went to church, but didn't do it. But then coming to the monastery, we do it. All the monks, we do it every 2 weeks. And that's one kind of aspect of the spiritual friendship, is that different monks have different problems and different kind of non-problems. So if I have, you know, a certain issue with something, it is the case that I can find a monk or a friend in the holy life who doesn't have those problems, or even better than that, is someone who has had those problems in the past, but then has been able to like work with them. And then if I can, you know, confess or kind of lay myself out and say, okay, you know, I'm having this trouble, or I did this, and it has meaning. I mean, we go through our confession and it is like a rote formula, but if we can bring it to someone who actually, has dealt with those kind of things or is dealing with those kind of things, then it can be that much more powerful. And that's just one kind of boon that we have as the Sangha here. And it seems like that can also, you don't have to live in a Sangha. You can just make a agreement with your friends, you know, to kind of make these aspirations and things. Yeah, I've appreciated the talks so far. Just so people know, the instance that Tankachana brought up about having glass in his foot, that's a pretty common occurrence in Thailand. There's actually a translation book that's called the Prat Pharang Thai Primer, which is it's like the Western monk Thai primer, and it's got all kinds of sentences that you'll use, like in Thailand, like, where do I wash my bowl? Or one of them is, I have some glass in my foot, Ajahn. So it's like, it's a common enough occurrence. So we don't, as Buddhist monks, we don't search out that kind of thing. But if it happens, we can deal with it in Thai or in English. So again, appreciation for all the community, and I look forward to everybody else's talks.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So I don't have much of a plan coming to mind, but I thought maybe I would just briefly share some of my experiences and what I found useful. I've certainly resonated with the comments about needing to find out what works for oneself. It's something that's resonated with me is needing to work with the higher principles. Like we all need to cultivate the skillful, abandon the unskillful, purify the mind and heart. But how we do that is personal, individual. Found it helpful and have largely given up hope of being the ideal perfect monk. I'm not going to be perfect with all my chanting and, you know, always have all my requisites perfect in every way, but I still have hope, faith that someday, some lifetime, the end of suffering is possible. It's just thinking it's going to be a long, have to be in it for the long haul and see what, you know, little baby steps, little various tricks, strategies to get there. I've been thinking about what's been working well this past Vasa, and you know, just finding little core watts. This one advice once given is to just have personal core watts or sort of personal protocols. For example, I confess, at least for this lifetime, as long as I can remember, I've been fond of sleeping, and yeah, something that's not so helpful. And so something I'm working with, and so I have a spiritual friend, if I ever over an app, go over the limit I've set for myself, then I confess to him. And yeah, like so personal things like that. And usually I have a sort of, I have to get out of my cootie by a certain time, or else I sort of give something up that I would usually have at breakfast. And it's just like a tiny thing, but I can tell this part of me that's like, well, I want to have that. And it's like, well, then get up. So just using these small encouragement things. And Tan Kovilo and I both did a sort of a determination for the Vasa to do the Itipiso chanting. Every vigil, every mandatory vigil, we would do it. And, you know, just make small things, I think, gives oneself a sense of confidence and momentum. One of the first spiritual teachers I ever had, who I was in, when I was in college, you know, he would tell people, you know, just walk around the block every day, you know. And then, you know, also another one in college would just say, you know, just start meditating for, you know, 5 minutes or 10 minutes a day. But it's just, if you just do something and then you keep it up, then you start building that sense of confidence. And something quite useful I found about the little sort of core watts or protocols is it helps in that, you know, if I have a determination to get out of my hut by a certain time, or if I don't, then I can't have that thing at breakfast, then it works quite well, because if I don't do it, then I just give something up at breakfast, or give something up, whatever. But then there isn't that sort of guilt and remorse that I have to hang around, because I've sort of made that sacrifice, you know, in the sense that you have a determination, and if you don't do it, this is the consequence, and then that's it. You know, it's, you don't have to drag it on. It's like, okay, I didn't do what I was hoping to do, but the consequence is such and such, so... I guess having been here for maybe more than 7 years at this monastery, I've found it very useful to have filled up my head with lots of stories, because I feel like I came into the monastery 8 years ago with lots of negative narratives and stories and voices. And just recently I've been, for whatever reason, having a lot of trouble being skillful in my speech and often saying things that really I wish I hadn't said. And mostly the monastics are the ones who have been hearing this. But then I thought, I assume kind of down about this. But then I remembered the story about Ajahn Chah and how there was this monk at his monastery who just had a good heart but a bad mouth. And, and Ajahn Chah really, you know, was happy to have him there and thought, you know, it was important. And so maybe that's enough for now, Alfred, for your consideration.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. It's the case in the monastic life, and this is something I really appreciate about the senior monks, and something I really look up to, is that once one becomes stable in the practice, it just becomes natural to be investigating some aspect of the teaching, to have some sort of running theme at any point in time, and to have some list or some framework for looking at the world as a reference point. And there have been times when this has been really natural for me, and so when I realized that these talks would be going forward, and my first thought was, okay, well, what have I been working with? What's been my framework? What have I been cultivating? Because naturally that would be the most fresh. It would have the most clear insights. And those who might have been keeping track of what I've been up to as I've been puttering around the monasteries, there has my pursuits for this vasa have been very, very engaging ones that require a lot of concentration, and things like making requisites or learning the Bhikkhu's monastic rules, and these require such precision, attention to detail that kind of squash any real capacity to analyze the teachings. It uses the same muscles of the mind. So as I thought back, I just came up blank. I didn't know what framework I'd really been cultivating. And so I tossed it around in my head a little bit, like, well, maybe I can I've still got 12 hours. Maybe I can come up with a good one and some really good insights and just have that to offer. But and of course, it came to mind the natural escape clause for anyone in the Buddhist practice. Oh, I can talk about mindfulness. Because certainly while I didn't have a framework to kind of encapsulate all of my activities over the past few months, I have been engaged in practice and I have been cultivating, and what I've been cultivating is the reason it had no structure behind it was because it was mindfulness itself. Being cognizant of the mind and its aspects as it was moving from one activity to the next, and that's what I was cultivating, somewhat intentionally. Certainly, I find I'm very interested in having a continuity of practice, to being able to move from one activity to the next, and certainly in this tradition we. We don't neglect activities. We have a lot that we're willing to do, a lot that we're willing to accept, responsibilities we're willing to take on, in addition to the formal practice. So certainly, it's always appropriate. I've heard one teacher say that mindfulness is the highest tier of skills. In and of itself, you don't really get a product from it. Like if you were to learn sewing, you could apply that skill to making robes. If you learn wicker weaving, you could make a bowl stand for one of our bowls. But if you develop one of those skills, it's on a lower tier. You couldn't necessarily use your sewing skills for patching a damaged steel bowl. It just wouldn't be applicable. Whereas if you cultivate mindfulness, you don't necessarily get any product other than composure of mind. But that skill will be ultimately applicable to anything else you might do. And I rather like that because it's the idea that there's many opportunities. I mean, I could go out and become a baker and, you know, I'd have this great skill to bake bread, but it wouldn't necessarily help me if I was in a car accident so far from the oven, you know. what would I do? It's I would have cultivated the wrong skill set, and life is like that. You don't necessarily have all the skills at your disposal, and that in and of itself is a great reason to be here. Is a great reason to practice, because. I've seen that. I've seen that. You know, any skill set, even if done really well, is not in and of itself liberating. Is not in itself an end, but rather mindfulness. Yeah, is different in just that way. In that cultivated one advances in all skills. And certainly more slowly, I think those who have seen the effect of many years of practice in a person can recognize that's exactly what's happening, is that bad habits are being abandoned and good habits are being picked up, and people become more graceful, more humble, more attentive and more open. It's a natural process of cultivating the mindfulness, and the crux of the matter, though, is to know what mindfulness is and when it's there and when it's not there. Lungpur was addressing some medical professionals just the other day, psychologists and counselors, and he was just noticing out loud that mindfulness has been sort of taken up by popular culture. It's become a sort of buzzword. And the same as in the monastic profession, you could say, oh, I'm mindful dishwashing, I'm doing mindful sweeping. It's the same in the world. You can be mindful of anything, but it doesn't necessarily, it's easy to say, but it's not necessarily accurate. Another teacher I heard talking on the subject of mindfulness, he came at it from the Abhidhamma approach, a sort of point-by-point analysis, a very deep and intellectual study of the subject. And he related the commentaries to the Buddhist teaching developed over a length of time by various teachers. And he said that they listed, I think it was dozens of mental factors, constituents, that enter into the process of mindfulness, and that all of these have a very logical process, and they go from one to the next. And it's consciousness and mental activity and recognition and, you know, the sense bases and all of this. He said just those in and of themselves don't equal mindfulness, that the commentaries put at the very end of this long causal chain a particular mental constituent, and it's just right there at the end, like the dot on an exclamation point. And I think he called it something like Tata Rung. And he was saying that, as I understood it, that it's basically this doesn't have any other function except to, when the commentaries describe mindfulness, they say mindfulness occurs when this constituent happens. And that's another way of saying that unless all of the constituents have gone through their natural course and arrived at their end point, and that the mind has been present through all of them, and it hasn't gone off on a diversion and gotten lost in a sensation or a feeling or a thought that derailed it before this point, you can't really call it mindfulness. There won't be a fullness to it. And what that said to me was a wholeheartedness, is that when one knows that they're being mindful, one has a sense of that, you know, what they're doing is wholehearted, and that when one is not fully reaching understanding or not fully experiencing mindfulness, not fully experiencing the moment, when all of the mind is not composed and gathered, then it won't necessarily feel complete. There'll be something missing. And when one has a grasp of that, they can also recognize how this, when it does happen, it's impermanent. And certainly, I think as human beings, we have an innate desire, innate sense that wholeheartedness, mindfulness is better. It's as Buddha compared it to salt. He said, just as a way that a pinch of salt improves the flavor of any curry. You could say maybe any soup, just a pinch of salt will improve it. It's true. It doesn't matter what kind of soup it is, minestrone or chicken noodle, cream of mushroom. Just a little pinch of salt makes it better. And in the same way, true mindfulness will improve anything. It'll be that little bit of flavor to an experience. And so as people, we notice that, and it makes us perk up, and we want it. So when one does experience this, In early stages of practice, usually by accident, it becomes a goal in and of itself to get that experience. But one will notice quite quickly is that it's there. It's just that exclamation point, that little dot, and then it's gone. It's just a blip in the mind. And then there's a space, there's a gap, and the mind continues through all its other processes. So then the practice, engaging in mindfulness, is to further develop this capacity to wholly to allow the mind to complete this causal chain, to allow the mind to fully grasp, to fully recognize, to fully encompass anything that it's doing, and therefore be fully with it. And though this experience will just be a blip in the mind, as those blips become more constant, become more often, it will certainly serve to illuminate what it is we try to do in developing mindfulness, how it is we could, skills are not in and of themselves liberating again, but this is a skill which will sort of bring everything together. It'll sort of compose and steady the mind. And when it goes from being a blip to a sort of steady tone of mindfulness, that's the point when one is wholly engaged, is wholehearted, is effective in what they're doing, and that's when they really have the ability to make decisions, is no longer reacting, but to really direct the mind and to really come to an understanding of where they are and what they're doing and what their goals are. I'll maybe just offer that as a few reflections on the subject of mindfulness for tonight.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. A couple hours ago, I had a completely different idea of what was going on in my mind. And after a couple hours of talks, things have changed. A lot of what I've been reflecting on recently, and really for years, is how much my mind likes to make things complicated. And so a lot of my practice is just being simple or keeping things simple. So if I'm moving, then it's paying attention to my body or my legs, especially my lower legs when I'm walking. And then when I'm sitting or just still, just trying to pay attention to the breath. And then like Tan Kachana was saying about reflections, I find that just in the space of that exercise, that activity of being aware of the breath or being aware of the body moving, especially in this environment, reflections just come up naturally. It's almost impossible to prevent them. And this can be similarly done in lay life, of course. If you're spending enough time reflecting on practice or studying or just keeping near to the Dhamma. And one of the things I'll often do when I'm trying to keep things simple is just see if I have the ability to not entertain complexity. So is it actually possible for my mind to just be aware of the breath and be content with that? And it's actually rare that that's the case, honestly. So even with the activity of reflection, I'll sometimes not even attend to that and just class it under the whim of the mind, as I think if that phrase was used earlier. That this mind and heart has tendencies that really have quite a momentum that, bring up certain reflections, bring up certain tendencies to practice. And even those can be let go of from time to time. And this is just, it's not in the vein of discounting them, but it's just in the vein of seeing the possibility of keeping things simple, keeping things brief in terms of practice. I think I'll be working on that for a while, and just keeping it simple, just trying to be aware of the body with clarity and being aware of the breath with clarity. And and to me that seems like enough most of the time. And when it doesn't feel like enough, usually that's exactly when I need to come back to the body, to the breath, and to the movement of the body. So I think I'll leave it at that.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namasami. Don't expect me to say a lot. Recently I studied the Dhammapada and reading compare different translation, and so different. And now listen to the people talking, giving the talk, and some different words come up to the mind. Like when Anakaraka John talking, when how difficult is working in the kitchen, and one verse, the Buddha said, the hunger is the greatest disease. So you don't know you make how much merit by just feeding the monk. The monk, we couldn't cook, and we get hungry every day, so we had to eat every day. So we have so much appreciation for the cook and whoever doing it. In that verse, have more. He said, "The sankhara is the greatest dukkha." And if we see that clearly, and then to realize the Nibbana, the highest bliss. And when I listened to Tanditapanyo saying he indulged in sleep, and then and another verse from it said something like, when the fool who indulged in sleep and eating, lolling in the bed, like a big fat pig. he will rebirth again and again. Yes. Sorry, but that's the Buddha said it. Okay. And this morning we went to Rulitz to perform Binnabat, and when we stand in the market there, and we go so early, and the market wasn't open, and or they have some people waiting there for get into the market, and one lady, he came with a stiff. I think her name is Karen Sue. I think, yeah, it's her birthday, and she quite really happily to waiting there and then go into the market and get a lot of a basket of food and to offer. And another lady, come later, and she also asked us if he can offer some, and then we said, oh yeah. And when she came out, we see we already have a big basket of food, and he was surprised. Wow, yeah. That whole basket for you. And Ajahn Chodipalo said, yeah, that's, we take it back to share with the community. And at that point, one word come up is like, hasten to do good and refrain the mind from evil. If we slowing doing good, the mind decline in evil. So I can see, look like the second lady look like a little bit hold back. So first she really want to offer. Like, I don't know how much she want to offer, but see later she offer, still offer, but not them, I don't know, just. Perhaps we see we have a big pocket already, and offer less, so I don't know, I could not tell. But there's sometimes we could do is, if we don't do it right away, we might stop doing the good thing. And one more verse. We also see many of the wanderers, like, I don't know if they're homeless or not. They just have a big pack and in the park or on the sidewalk or the street. And I asked Ajahn Chodipalo, today we have look like I have a lot of homeless people around. And he said maybe, I don't remember what they say. could be have a, if they might be have a group of community, something. But have a verse come up. This one I really try to memorize. Even the Pali, I already know. But I say in English, it's it's difficult to live as a monk, and difficult to delight therein. And it's also difficult to live as a household life. And it's painful. It's painful to association with the people who is unequal. And it's, well, it's difficult or painful. It's endlessly wandering in samsara. And so don't be endlessly wandering. And don't be a pursuer of suffering. Something like that. So the wandering, some translation says it's a traveler. So don't be a traveler. So look like, I don't know if they suffer or not, but they look, maybe they're happy. I could not tell, but I can see suffering in, even we are not traveling by our physically here, but our mind look like travel all the time, and that's really, I can see, so that's suffering. Maybe that's another one.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Bodham Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So I think that one of the things that I most appreciate about this about this lifestyle, about this training, is the way that the training is really designed, structured to push us, to challenge us. I found that it pushes us in ways that I know for myself that I would never choose to push myself. Certainly living out in the world, I dealt with suffering in many ways, mostly trying to avoid suffering, trying to run away from suffering, trying to distract myself, anything but actually being with suffering, anything but actually having to look at myself, look at my own negative qualities. And after trying that for a long time, then realizing that that doesn't work. Searching for happiness, peace, contentment out in the world is, it's just not possible to find it out there. So I've come here to stop distracting myself, to stop running away, and to really investigate my own heart investigate. The various stains, defilements that are in my own heart, and to learn how to overcome them. And I've found just living here for the past few years that the way that this particular community, particular lifestyle is structured, just having to live in a community of people, having a daily schedule, it's inevitable that you don't get along with everyone, you don't agree with everyone. Sometimes you have to work with people that you maybe don't like, you don't get along with. Sometimes you have to do things that you don't like, that you maybe don't feel skilled at, you don't feel competent at. Sometimes you might have ideas about how things should be done, and other people have other ideas. Maybe everyone has a different idea than you. A lot of times during the day you have to do things that you would rather not be doing. Maybe, even as a monk, maybe you prefer to, be off in the forest meditating all day. But living in a community, then you have certain responsibilities and duties. In all of these ways, then, it really allows the defilements to come up. And then living in this container, then we don't really have any other choice but to look at them, to acknowledge them. You can't really run from them. So yeah, just to express appreciation for the structure of this community, for the people who are in this community. Feel incredibly grateful for being challenged. It's allowed me to see things about myself that I didn't want to see, and it's allowed me to start working on myself, purifying my own heart. So leave that for reflection.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassami. Such an incredibly rich evening, and I notice that when someone else's name gets called, I really sit back and relax and enjoy it. And then there's this peace when Lumpur's rattling in the bowl and something else happens inside and not so relaxed. So the winter retreat theme, January, February, March, was on the Thai forest tradition. And when I was looking through readings, each person in the resident community got to do a reading about 3 times. And I was reading, it was a student living with Ajahn Chah, a monastic living with Ajahn Chah, and I've tried to find the reading and I haven't been able to, but he asked a question of Ajahn Chah about the metta practice. And Ajahn Chah spoke about its unbounded nature. And he didn't say much else about it. And there was something in that that just set me off on a bit of a voyage of discovery or a theme of contemplation. And I'm starting to learn that when the mind is drawn to something, just to sort of let it go and it'll find its way somewhere. And so I started noticing all of the very vast words, like the Brahmaviharas, so metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, they're called the immeasurables. And then we talk about samsara being a beginning, since beginningless time, where the Buddha said that it's not possible to discover the beginning of samsara. And spotless in the highest blessings. I remember very clearly the last day that we saw Iris in Redwood Valley, there were a few monks that went to chant and farewell her. Debbie was there, there were a few other people there, and Ajahn Kurunadamo sat on one side with 2 other monastics, and I was on one side for a little while of her bed. And he just led her very, very quietly, and he talked about the peace and the highest blessings, about spotless. If I had a memory, I'd remember the rest of it. But the spotless, just spotless, but by itself, again, for me, is one of those, you know, imagine something without a spot, without a blemish. And so, you know, just noticing the mind attending to those things, and like then for me thinking, so how do I bind myself? Like how am I limited, and when is that limiting nature noticeable for me? And so I started noticing how when I'm feeling aversion, irritation to something or someone, it's very, very focused. So if I'm thinking about a camera, it's like I'm zooming in on one particular thing, and just it's going round and round and round, and it feels very tight, it feels very confined, it feels very like I am binding myself. And for me the benefit of thinking about those very vast terms is so to notice when they're not present, and then not to notice unbounded, because I'd be awakened if I was unbounded, but to then notice when there are times when there is way less constriction, less tightness, less limiting. And it happens for me, it seems always to be related to the wholesome states arising, feelings of very deep gratitude, that feels very like expansive. I even notice how the body changes when there's those, you know, gratitude, generosity, really going into patient endurance, and realizing that through a practice of kanti, of patient endurance, one's just able to stay a lot longer with something that I wasn't able to before. So just, and the breathing can change as well. The breathing can become quite relaxed, and the body can become quite relaxed. And it brings to mind, there are a couple of times at the winter retreat, the crew last year were doing, and I think there was Debbie at one stage as well, doing meals in memory of people, dana meals. I think it was March, and my memory is that it began with Jeannie wanting to prepare a meal in memory of her mother, but then so many people also got involved. People on the retreat crew, there was Debbie, myself, I think there were some other people. And the list, when Lumpur read it out, of the people that this dana was in memory of, was long. But that morning in the kitchen, it was extraordinary. It was like the dana, the generosity, the respect for those people that had passed on, the respect for one another, the harmony in the kitchen. It just felt like one wholesome state blending into another wholesome state, and it was just that when we do that chant, I will abide pervading the mind. And there's that line that's abundant, exalted, immeasurable. It felt so much like that. And the winter retreat before, I became really interested, and it was Iris that actually recommended this in the Lamrim teachings in the book called The Words of My Perfect Teacher by Patril Rinpoche. And what I appreciate about that is they're vast. I mean, they're like just an example, thinking about the preciousness of a human life and the rarity of a human life. That, you know, and there's all of those terms, those eons that we've been wandering around in beginningless samsara. The fact that we have a human birth, that a human birth is very, very beneficial for exploring the Dharma, that we have the Dharma, that there is a Buddha, and the teachings are available, and there are many places, you know, like just online, for example, but that we here sitting in this room and many others come to a place like Abhayagiri, it's extraordinarily rich as an opportunity. And then I was fortunate to go to Old Gold Mine in May, and part of that trip we had visits from the nuns from Srivasti Abbey. Four of them came and helped tree plant one day. And then we called in at Srivasti Abbey on the way back down to White Salmon. And I was just really enjoying the nuns very much as individuals, as a community. Their teacher, Venerable Thupten Chodron, wasn't there, unfortunately. But such a lovely community and such inspiring, hard-working group of nuns. So I picked up a couple of books, and one of them had guided meditations on Lamrim teachings. And so Venerable Thupten Chodron had realized that the Lamrim teachings, I mean, that book, Words of My Perfect Teacher, and the other one Ajahn Janaka recommended, Liberation in the Palm of My Hand, you know, like they're thick. They're like 3 or 4 inches thick. And she'd realized that many people had interest, but they didn't quite know what to do with them, how to work with them. So she put together a CD, and I think it's about 52 different guided meditations on that. And in the seclusion period I had over the rains retreat, I started listening and working with those, and I just echoed Tan Kachana's theme on the benefits of repetition. I chose a couple of them that really resonated, and aspire to do them daily. And one of them is called the 9-point meditation on death, and the other one is the taking refuge in the Buddha. But how this fits together with what I've been saying about immeasurable boundlessness, it's you in the meditation on the Buddha, it's actually the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And the visualizations are not complex like some in the Tibetan tradition. But you kind of set up what she calls a merit field. So you imagine all the Buddhas, arahants, saints, holy saints, they don't have to be Buddhist at all, who have passed on. And the Sangha, and just all of those in front of you. And you're sitting there with, I think you have your parents alongside, but all sentient beings. And so this is like the mind goes, huh? It's just you see the limit, because it's very difficult to imagine all of that. But that there's value, I think, for me, because day after day, there's many things that happen in that visualization, that guided meditation. It's about 35 minutes long. You know, you think about the qualities involved with the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And It's like taking refuge in that. It's taking refuge in something that has the potential to be boundless, has the potential to take us out of the cyclic existence of samsara. You ask forgiveness at a different point, you make offerings, you do all sorts of things, but like I said, it helps me to see when the mind can't go to that expansive state. And then that helps me to see when I'm doing that, when I have views, when I have opinions, when I have reactions, I feel that limiting nature. And then I can work with a whole lot of different tools to let it go. One of the things that idea of immeasurables and with how to work with that, one thing I do if I have a restless mind, and another way for me of looking at a restless mind is an energetic mind. It's a bit of a reframe, really, that it wants work to do. So say, for example, I might go, I'll use that then instead of just trying to get to the breath and I keep wandering off somewhere. And I'll go A to Z in terms of thinking of, usually it's a group of people, but something that will arouse compassion for me. So I might do A, addiction, B, I had a friend whose father worked with parents who'd lost their babies. So, you know, babies, C, children that are orphans or something. So it's kind of like using the mind, but for me it's, using it to encourage wholesome states, which is part of what the Buddha taught for right effort, for the arising of wholesome states, the maintaining of wholesome states. And just seeing also how sila fits into that as well. That, you know, the benefit of living over time on 8 precepts, for me particularly with something like right speech, really also beginning to notice how when I am unskillful in speech, even unskillful in the mental realm, how uncomfortable it is and how, again, that tight, kind of limited, constricted feeling occurs. So not wanting to... And for me, out in the world, there was just so much going on that our simple kind of repetitive structure here gives the opportunity to see these things, see and feel these things much more clearly, and also be surrounded by a community and many... We have many visiting teachers as well who giving us tools, giving us ways to work with what's arising as it arises. And just to follow the theme of appreciation, I feel incredibly grateful to be here. Somehow I got here from the other side of the world, and it's a great blessing to be here alongside people who've really given their life with the aspiration to experience awakening.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So I was just going to come up here and say, Pumi panya. My mi panha, ewang. But Tangkaspo said a lot more than that, and if he could go on for longer than that, I probably have to. So he ruined that for me. So I've been reading a lot of Lumpu Pien Wiryo, and like pretty much all Krupa Ajahns, he talks a lot about Asubha Kamatana, contemplation of the unattractiveness of the body. And I do that a lot myself, so I'll just talk about that a bit. And I think one of the reasons the Krupa Ajahns stress it so much is because it's probably the most just lust is just the most fundamental kilesa for pretty much everyone. It's the most bold and the most clever, really. I mean, it can have us believing that a filthy sack of excrement, urine, pus, blood, and all sorts of unattractive things is the most, just the most beautiful thing in the world. It can have us spending our whole lives chasing after a sack of this nasty, smelly stuff. If it were a marketing agent or something, it would be like the highest paid in the world. So it's just excellent at what it does. So, Kruba Ajahn's stress it, so it's probably worth considering.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Bhutang tamang sanghang namasami. So I can completely echo what Samanera Cantico said, is kind of this theme was running through my mind, and then listening to talks, and then the theme was shifting, and then it was getting lost, and trying to let it go, and just be present for everybody's talk, but it triggers other things. And the one thing I was noticing was just watching as everybody came up. And what came up for me was, we have these and I'm going to be lost for the words, but these formal ways of begin coming to give a talk. Everybody comes up and pays respects to Lumpur, and all these formalities that are built into this structure of training. And one of the beauties of them is that it really helps us to recollect our energies, our mindfulness, to pull it back in, to not let the mind get lost in, I'm going up there now, what am I going to say? Am I going to be able to say whatever might be proliferating in there? We have certain kind of ritual in a way that helps us to recollect ourselves, to gather ourselves, to collect ourselves. It's one of the very beautiful things that this training has to offer, and it's actually offered equally to everybody in just slightly different forms. One thing that really struck me in a big way, I've been here for a long time and I've reflected on this before, but this hit me in a really powerful way and kind of went just a little bit deeper in my appreciation for the understanding. And that was an event that happened in August, and we lost one of our quite senior monks, very loved member of the community. And in this process for him of deciding to leave the robes, he did things, I know he consulted with Lumpur, but he did things in such a beautiful manner, in a well-thought-out manner, in a very respectful manner. And where it might have been a lot easier to just have kind of left and then disappeared, he let people know ahead of time. He talked to individuals in the community. He I know he came and talked to Beth and I, and then I know he talked to the monastics at their gathering that they do after the Padimokkha. He endured people's different reactions, and this wasn't an easy thing for our community to lose this being, because it's someone that had been around for a while, had been giving very beautiful teachings, was a really lovely presence. And one thing that really struck me very profoundly, really, about the whole process, and I felt such gratitude to him and to just the community and just this training. And it's something that in some situations, had it been done rashly, quickly, without any kind of consideration, it would have potentially left some pretty murky water in its wake. And instead, what I felt was it was difficult. We were there, the whole community was there for the actual disrobing process, and it was extremely difficult and painful in moments to observe. But what came up, and I know I wasn't alone in this, was this feeling of strength in a way, and just the beauty of the way it was done allowed people to feel supportive of each other. I felt a greater sense of harmony. People really making the effort to just support the community. And so the reflection that really came up for me in a big way was just how there's cause and effects, and there's things that we do. Sometimes we have to respond very quickly, and it's not so easy to pause and be circumspect. And then that's when our training comes into play. And sometimes we have the opportunity to be more circumspect and to really give things consideration and know that we're giving things our fullest consideration with good intention. And then we take the step, whatever that might be. Sometimes it's more challenging than others. It just really is so beautiful to sit here and listen to all the different talks that people have offered, sharing of their own practice. It must feel good to Lumpur just to see that people are really applying themselves and their dedication to this practice. And just fills one with a lot of joy, and of course there's always gratitude. Yeah, so just I think that's a reflection I'm still holding, is how to be as skillful as possible in my actions. And gratitude for the guidelines that we have in our foundations of Sila. The opportunity to sit with a group of, with a community of monastics and lay people dedicated to the practice. And the support that we all give each other.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namasami. We've covered a lot of ground this evening. I've appreciated every bit of it. So don't be surprised if you hear something familiar. Yeah, I've just heard so many themes that have resonated with me so deeply. So, yeah, just some things that, yeah, they just reminded me of yeah, reflections and ways of practice that have helped me, so. something that always, when I use like the sobering reflections of, say, death, or especially recently, being part of the community when monks either here or hearing elsewhere disrobing, these reflections for me beg the question, well, why am I here? Why did I take the robes? Why am I living in community? It's certainly a very multifaceted answer. A number of feelings and images and things, intentions come up depending on the situation and so forth. But I really do find it instructive to try to answer that question as deeply as possible and often, repeating it. In the world, I had a number of pretty diverse group of people that I spent time with and hung out with, and a lot of them, were actually really pretty intent on making the world a better place, so to speak, in their own way, in their own ways of doing things. And I think I've always had an inclination for that, but I definitely strengthened by, especially recently before coming to the monastery in the past few years before arriving, I felt like there's more of those people in my life. And so this question that actually was kind of brought up tonight in a different way, how is one in the world and how is the world affecting one, or how is the world in one? And so, the mind and the world, the body and its environment, this relationship, how do you, what is that, and what's the process and what's the dynamic? And when you're looking at this, there's sort of this dichotomy, say, that comes up, different models or whatever. And one, maybe to put succinctly, is that, the world changes you. So sort of like you are the subject, sort of, or the object being acted upon by the world. And it affects you, and you are in some way enslaved to your environment, the people around you. Maybe the other way is, that you go out and act upon the world. I always really appreciated the Gandhi quote, you must be the change you want to see in the world. And that sort of motivation, that sort of like changing myself in order to help the world, was a major influence for me taking on meditation and then, of course, taking the robes. But interestingly enough, I found myself changing my environment in order to change myself, in order to change the environment. And it brings up this paradox. And it goes back to that question of, what's this dynamic that's going on? Is it really separate, or where is it separate, where is it not? And I have a lot of favorite suttas, but one of them is, it's in the Sanyutta Nikaya, it's called the Sedaka Sutta, or it's more commonly known as the Simile of the Acrobats. And I've never found a more beautiful answer to this question, and it addresses it specifically. And as the story goes, there's there are these acrobats, and they, of course, want to do a good job. And I don't remember the exact sequence, but there's the teacher is on the ground holding a pole, usually I think it's vertically, and then the student is climbing up the pole and doing a routine up top. And yeah, like I said, I forgot the exact sequence, but the teacher, I think the teacher says first, he says to the student, well, you look after, I'll look after you, and you can look after me, and in this way, we'll be successful and, you know, impress people and get money and so forth. And the student says, no, whoa. How about I look after myself and you look after yourself? And in that way, you know, things will be successful. Now, recently I read a comparative study of this specific sutta, comparing it with a parallel in Chinese and classical Chinese translation. It's actually, this is the two are identical up to this point, and then they diverge. And I actually appreciated the version extent in Chinese translation more. And the teacher goes on to say, yes, exactly. that's exactly, you know, that's what I said. And, you know, by looking after ourselves, we look after each other. And then, so the Buddha is telling the story, and he says, so looking after yourself, you look after others, and looking after others, you look after yourself. And now what does that mean? So he says, looking after yourself, one practices the four satipatthanas, or the establishments or foundations of mindfulness. So essentially one's meditation practice. But, of course, not just, you know, a single technique, but the satipatthana encompasses a whole range and breadth and depth of, you know, samatha vipassana, and the whole practice can be encapsulated in that. And then I forgot what it is that comes next in the Chinese, but in the Pali, though, the Buddha lists four qualities to be cultivated in order to look after others. And they are metta, ahimsa, kanti, and anudaya. So goodwill is the first quality, metta. Ahimsa, which is harmlessness or non-violence. Kanti is patience, sort of patient endurance. And anudaya is less common, but it's often translated as sympathy. And so I've thought a lot about this, and living in community, and, you know, how does community affect you? And really, I mean, so much of my practice for so long has been, you know, you have these two questions about, like, you know, do you change the world by going out and change other people, or does the world affect you? And it's like, well, let's try to find a way where helping oneself is helping others, and helping others is helping oneself. And of course, it's deceptively simple, but the principle, I think, is incredibly profound and applicable. This is Pavarana day, and so we've, especially this Vasa time, is the emphasis is definitely put on community, and of course this time right now from Pavarana, and then on to this festival day coming up, Katina. It's an emphasis on community, and much of the Vinaya deals with communal harmony, and that's sort of what Katina celebrates, is a community that's lived for 3 or 4 months together and is, you know, still living together. So And again, coming back to this question, you know, and so during the Vasa, we have every other night, every couple nights, depends on the schedule, we have these classes on the monastic discipline, the Vinaya. So there's different themes and different frames every year that we approach these. But always, again, it really comes back to this question, like, well, why, you know, why do I want to follow this rule, you know? And sure, you can do it by rote. You can just do it because the tradition says it's good or the Buddha said it was good or whatever. And that can certainly be a fruitful way of approaching things. But I find myself doing that in this community, but I find that the most interesting way or the most fruitful way to approach it is to really investigate, well, what are the benefits? Because, you know, as many people may know, the Buddha was actually asked by one of his senior disciples to, you know, to just flat out lay out the rules, just list a whole bunch of stuff that's really good and, you know, get it over with, and everyone will have these rules. And as the tradition says, it's actually not how it happened. The Buddha said, no, we'll say play it by ear. When things become a problem, we will address the problem and continually refine it. I decline to list all the rules at the beginning. So behind every rule, there's an origin story, we call it. So it's the beginning of every rule starts off by describing the situation and who are the characters and what did they do and what did the community think and the lay people think, and then of course followed by the Buddha hearing of it and laying down some sort of rule, injunction, recommendation, etc. So there really is, you know, none of this is sort of idle thought or just making stuff up. It really, everything, even if some of the origin stories are a little strange, but the flavor throughout the entire Vinaya is that, no, look, these were real people and there were real problems to solve, and this is how the communities and the Buddha went about trying to solve these problems. So when I look at rules and regulations, that's the question that I ask is, well, what are the benefits and why do I personally want to do this? You know, there's a... And so part of one of the... A theme that's actually come up recently within the past week or so, people have asked various questions and there's been various conversations and, you know, the monks and even this evening, we've talked about food and hunger and eating. And the monks, you know, we don't store food. We don't ask for food. We don't cook food. We don't grow food. You know, we eat food. But, you know, so what does that mean and how does that work? Well, this is actually there's a many, 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 many rules dealing with food in the Vinaya. But one of the most important ones, one of the sort of these cornerstones of what makes a monastic, is a rule on not storing food, which is additionally interesting because this is one of the few rules, it's the only one that I can bring to mind right now, that is actually the first monk to do something that the Buddha then found censurable. He was actually finished with the practice. He was an arahant. He was awakened. And he was actually storing rice in order to be frugal, and to be less of a burden, and to cultivate seclusion. Totally, I mean, seemingly blameless. But yet, this rule was laid down that monks cannot store food, even if we just want to cultivate seclusion and all these things. And so the long and the short of it is that these food rules are there for creating a symbiotic relationship with the lay community. essentially keeping us in contact, you know, whether it's inviting people to come and cook for us in the monastery and help us store the food, or walking out on alms round every day. It forces us to be dependent upon and in communication with lay people. If we keep these rules strictly, as we do in this community, we really can't just sort of check out, go up to the hills, and escape from, you know, the community in which, you know, the larger community in which we're embedded, you know, in this case, Redwood Valley, Northern California, and so on. So it keeps us, as monastics, I mean, it keeps us honest. I mean, if we aren't being good monastics, we aren't keeping the rules, we aren't providing interesting, useful, and helpful instruction, we aren't being an inspiration to people. And this actually, this happened in the time of the Buddha. You know, the lay people will become disappointed, and sooner or later they will stop feeding the monks, and the monks will either have to change their ways or disperse and go their separate ways. So but of course the other side of that is that when monks are practicing well and they are helping each other and helping the community around them, having to come into contact, either in, again, in inviting people or going out to the communities in the surrounding area, provides, you know, these offerings of help, you know, and provides an inspiration, a reminder that there are alternatives in the world to the normal workaday world, that there are people cultivating a skill set which is applicable in any situation, that in short is wholesome, you know, maybe in some ways, regardless of which, you know, whatever framework, religious or moral framework. I mean, I think most people would agree that the way that, you know, living frugally and living simply and cultivating goodwill and patience and these things, I mean, these are wholesome qualities. And the more that we work on ourselves is gives us the, you know, the ability to help our community members, you know, immediately. And because, you know, if we're not harming other people by body and speech, I mean, well, there's a lot, you know, there's a good chance they, you know, there's less of a chance for them to be harmed in general. But also we can use, as, you know, as happens often here, we use that in order to communicate to others what works for us and what doesn't work, and, you know, how we can go about making a difference, a tangible, honest, real difference in our life. And so there is this, yeah, this symbiosis, this mutual aid. This, you know, we help each other out, and it's this sort of feedback loop of wholesome qualities in its in ideally. And yeah, it's just when we go to work on ourselves, to when we go to, you know, formal meditation, sitting and walking meditation, when we go to do our reflections, I mean, these things, they're personal, and we have to do the work, and we have to take responsibility, and it's empowering. But it doesn't happen in a vacuum either, which is the really interesting part. So what we do with and two other people, you know, whether it's skillful or unskillful, affects us personally and affects our meditation, affects our reflections, affects our moods. And of course, the more that we're able to cultivate wholesome states. That's boundless. I mean, that echoes out and that ripples out in ways that we can't begin to understand. I offer this for your reflection this evening.
Well, it's delightful just to express appreciation to everybody, and then also we'll do a formal acknowledgement. Dhammayam dhammakathasadhukaram.